You've found the Diggin' Oak Island podcast, podcaster's journey to find the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. My name's Dave McBride. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. As always, I ask that you subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave us a five-star rating there if you would be so kind. And I also invite you to join me on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow the show at Diggin' Oak Island. Today we're going to discuss episode 6 of The Curse of Oak Island called Closing In. Before we do that, I have another listener email I want to read. This is starting to become a tradition, one I really love. Keep them coming, guys. I love this. It comes from a listener named Roger, and he writes, "Hi, Dave. I spent most of yesterday listening to all the episodes of the podcast. I must say, I really enjoy them. It did cause me to go back and watch the first few episodes of The Curse of Oak Island. In the first episode, I noticed that Rick Lagina mentioned that Smith's Cove was man-made. And in one of the later podcasts, you mentioned the same thing. My question is this. How do we know this? I mean, Rick just made that flat statement without any explanation. What proof is there that Smith's Cove was man-made? And the follow-on question is, for what reason? Also, in one of the last episodes, you mentioned carbon-14 dating, and it was used in the 19th century. Thinking that may have been a slip-up because carbon-14 dating wasn't perfected until the late 1940s or 1950s. Thanks for the great job, and keep it up. Again, thank you, Roger, so much, not only for taking the time to email me and talk about my favorite subject in the world, but also thank you for listening and those incredibly kind words. It really does make it all worthwhile. All the time and effort I put in this show, I mean, it makes it all worthwhile just to hear you and other listeners say that. So thank you again. Keep listening. Okay, let me first address that last point about carbon dating. Yes, Roger, I believe you found a mistake, and that gives me the opportunity to correct the record a bit here, and I do appreciate being afforded that opportunity. I did not listen back to the show, and most podcasters don't like to listen to the sound of their voice and can't understand why anybody else would, but I digress. But I did look back at the notes I had prepared for it, and I did write in there that carbon dating goes back to the mid-1900s. Now, it is very, very possible that I misspoke and missed that I misspoke and said that it went back to the mid-19th century instead of 1900s. If I did, let's be clear that Roger is absolutely correct. While carbon dating is comparatively old, it's kind of an older process compared to some of the newer techniques that you may see on the show being used. It is not 170 years old, so thanks again for that. Now let's talk about Smith's Cove. Roger asks, and I'll just repeat what he wrote here. In the first episode, I noticed Rick Lagina mentioned that Smith's Cove was man-made. And in one of the later podcasts, you mentioned the same thing. My question is this. How do we know this? I mean, Rick just made the flat statement without any explanation. What proof is there that Smith Cove was man-made? And the follow-on question is, for what reason? Well, Roger, what Rick is referring to, really what any researcher is referring to when they call Smith's Cove a man-made beach, in air quotes, is the actual extent, I think, it's the actual extent of the work that was done at Smith's Cove, seemingly for the purpose of laying down the famous box drains or finger drains that supply water to the flood tunnel system in the money pit. Not the drains themselves, but really this unbelievable amount of excavation work done in, centuries ago on the beach itself in order to create the system in the first place and be able to lay the system down. Okay, so let's tell the story a bit. It's 1850. A Truro company is working on the island, specifically in the money pit, and despite their best efforts to reach the treasure, they simply can't get past this flood system. After sinking piles of money and hours of backbreaking work, I mean, these guys are doing this stuff with hand shovels, they realized that getting past this flooding by going straight down the money pit was just not going to be accomplished, so they needed to find a way to stop the ocean from flowing into the pit. So they start searching for the source of that water, and the most logical place to start, due to its proximity to the money pit, is at Smith's Cove. So they go down there and they start looking around, and what they discover is nothing short of astonishing. Now, a lot has been written over the years about this moment, this huge seminal moment when the Truro Company finds this quote-unquote man-made beach. But it's one of the more recent accounts, the Randall Sullivan book, The Curse of Oak Island, that I think best captures the feeling that these guys must have had, and it also captures the incredible significance that the cove still has today. So let me read you a paragraph from his book, or part of it. Here he goes. He writes, "The company noticed almost immediately that all of the large stones had been removed from considerable expanse of the beach. Then, when the high tide began to ebb, the men observed that this section of the beach, quote, gulched forth water like a sponge being squeezed, as McCully described it. Now, McCully is the name of the man who was the sort of foreman of the work being done by the Truro Company at this time. The men stared at the water bubbling up through the surface and realized this couldn't be happening naturally. They began to shovel away the sand and stones. At a depth of 3 feet, the Truro Company found a 2-inch thick layer of brown stringy material they believed, correctly, to be coconut fiber. Below that was a thick layer of decayed eelgrass or kelp. And then he writes, there was and still is some debate which one that is. Tons of coconut fiber and most likely eelgrass were pulled away and piled into heaps along the shoreline until workers revealed a compact and remarkably clean mass of beach rocks protected from the sand and gravel on the surface of the beach by this 6-inch thick mat of coconut fiber and eelgrass. The men of the Truro Company could only guess how many tons of sand and clay had been removed from the surface of the beach to make room for both the filter and the rocks beneath, but it had to be 100,000 pounds at least, done by hand, folks. The work that had gone into this was stupefying to contemplate, because what had been created was a giant insulating sponge spread out for a length of 145 feet along the shoreline between the high and low tide marks. And that's the end of what Sullivan writes there. So let me just explain this a bit. Almost all of the shoreline of Oak Island is covered in big boulders. There's no real sandy beach per se on Oak Island. I mean, that's just kind of a feature of almost all of the North Atlantic, really from like mid-coast Maine on north. There are two places on the island where these boulders are strangely missing. One is called, creatively, the Boulderless Beach. It is a 100-foot section of shoreline on the north side of the island that is sort of mysteriously void of these kinds of big rocks. The other is Smith's Cove. Sullivan says that the workers from the Truro Company, quote, noticed almost immediately that all of the large stones had been removed from a considerable expanse of the beach, end quote. This is, at least in my mind, what we're talking about when we say man-made beach. Now, how they know these bigger rocks were removed and not just kind of naturally located somewhere else, I'm not entirely sure. But like I said, these kind of boulders covered almost all the island's shoreline. So it seems like a logical conclusion, at least. But when you then also factor in what lies beneath the surface, this layer of eelgrass, coconut fibers, and the like, you realize what Rick and I mean by man-made beach. I mean, if we assume Smith's Cove looked like the rest of the island before the original depositors came and did their thing, then in order to create this elaborate flood tunnel system, they essentially created a 145-foot-long beach. I mean, it's astounding when you think about it. These guys did this probably with shovels and, you know, the whatever the 17th century equivalent of a wheelbarrow is. But I hope that makes sense, Roger, for me and for many, including Randall Sullivan, for Rick Lagina, so many others. It is this man-made beach at Smith's Cove that is the most compelling piece of evidence that proves something very big happened on Oak Island a long time ago. What a great question. Thank you so much for that, Roger. And if you have any questions or comments and you want to email me and you'd like to have, you know, perhaps be read and discussed in a future podcast, feel free to do so. diginoakisland@gmail.com. So let's get into Season 7, Episode 6 of The Curse of Oak Island, called Closing In. It's an exciting episode with some really amazing work being done. So let's talk first about a couple of things not so amazing or so exciting. One of the main criticisms of the show that many viewers express, especially with regards to this season and last season, is what they call too much filler. These last two seasons both contain many more episodes than an earlier season, so these folks kind of moan about sort of too much non-significant stuff making it to air. Usually I don't agree. In my mind, the more I can see of this hunt, the better. But with this week's find by metal detecting expert Gary Drayton, they may have more of an argument than they usually do. So Gary and Peter Frenetti are detecting on Lot 32. Now, this is a lot which is just on the shoreline, the southern shoreline, just to the west of the swamp. Now, a while into the search, he mentions that things have gone quiet, meaning he isn't finding too much, but soon he gets to a signal or two, and he asks for Nettie to ding on them. They pull out two iron spikes. One looks like it's only a few inches long, and it seems pretty clear that much of it has been broken off, while the other is much longer and thinner, and it's also severely bent. Drayton says that the smaller spike is likely a decking spike, and he compares it to one they found earlier that was dated to the 17th century, likely of Spanish origin. You see this on the show. Keep that Spanish part in mind later in the podcast. So now later on in the show, Gary and Alex Lagina take the spikes to blacksmithing expert Carmen Legg. I love Carmen Legg. It's great wealth of knowledge, has a great accent. He says two other interesting things about it. The first is that the spike, I'm talking about the smaller one, is something that is very consistent with shipbuilding, confirming Drayton's suspicion. Without saying definitively that this is in fact a spike from an old ship, he comes awful close to that conclusion. Now let me pause here for a second. I don't normally give a lot of credence to social media stuff, but this week on social media, I don't remember where, I read a skeptic or a detractor making this point that it seems weird how Drayton always turns out to be correct in his initial guesses. You know, he pulls these dirty things out of the ground and he kind of looks at this whatever it is, crusted up into dirt, and he seems to be almost dead on as to what it actually is. I guess the inference here is that he finds these things, he researches them off camera, and then he reburies them for the scene and for the cameras so that he can discover it. And then I turn out to look like an expert. I don't know if we think this is an ego trip or what it is. I don't know. I've seen this in more than one occasion, by the way. Well, let me say this. If you spent decades doing what Drayton does, which is looking for basically shipwrecks, you too would become an expert on these types of things, just like Mr. Legg is, right? This is why Drayton is here. He has made a living, you know, not only finding jewelry on the beach and that kind of stuff, but also in finding artifacts of historic value. And ship spikes are those things. This is the type of stuff you find when metal detecting near the ocean. He's been doing this for decades. So I really think his guesses are pretty good. Anyway, the other thing Legg says about the smaller spike is that you would expect to find many of these things around the same area, considering how many it takes to build a ship. So if you got a shipwreck, you know, and the wood has deteriorated, the iron stays behind longer, you would think you'd find dozens and dozens of these things. However, he observes that the heavy amount of corrosion you see on it might indicate that most of the spikes you would expect to find alongside it have just completely eroded away. Now, Legg can't specifically date the spike. The corrosion probably makes that impossible, but he does say that the spike, that something like this would be commonly in use from about 1500s to really no later than 1820, which is, I guess, the time where these type of things were manufactured in a different way. You know, that process of manufacturing was significantly altered, so he would be able to recognize a more modern one. Now, also in this scene, with Carmen Legg here up at his shop, they only really discuss the shorter spike, basically never showing the longer bent one that they found near it, you know, not far from it on the beach. At the end of the scene, Alex, kind of in passing, says something about it being a mystery item that they need to do more work on. I would like to have heard what Legg actually said about it, but what can you do? Let me conclude this segment by saying I never like to dismiss any potential pieces of evidence presented by the show. So let me say that even though perhaps this wasn't the most groundbreaking discovery Drayton has ever made, it's still something. But I think there is a good argument to suggest at least that in shorter seasons from years gone by, perhaps this particular discovery would not have made the cut, so to speak, onto an episode. But you won't ever hear me complaining about seeing more of The Hunt. And at the end of the podcast, you will see just why producers were so anxious to have something maybe of Spanish origin related to discovered in this episode. Let's move now to the project that just might be the most significant this season, and that is the work being done to uncover something called Shaft 9. Okay, now last week I spent a lot of time explaining the significance of Shaft 9, but it seems apparent from reading these various social media sites that I keep complaining about that it's still a little confusing and not very clear to everyone watching. That's ironic considering one of the complaints I always read about from viewers is the narrator's constant repeating of all of information, but I digress. Okay, so Let me give you the nickel version of what's going on here. Like I said, go back to the last episode if you want to get a little more of a deep dive here. It's 1862. A group of searchers called the Oak Island Association dig a shaft near the money pit, which they used as a drain to help take seawater out of the original money pit and then hopefully assist them in getting to the treasure. So, you know, the money pit floods up to the tide level. So what they're trying to do is find a way to not just pump the water out, but really sort of efficiently move the water away from the money pit, giving them the opportunity to dry it out as best they can and continue digging past the water. Now, all that work is well documented, but apparently what wasn't well documented is that the company also dug something of a trench that led from Shaft 9 straight east out to the beach to help move this water, you know, all the way down into the ocean and drain it out into the ocean. Now, this group in its search, for all intents and purposes, comes up empty like all the others. And after only a couple of years and a few more attempts, work essentially stopped by, you know, a few more attempts by other companies, work essentially stops on Oak Island for a period of almost 30 years, about the late 1860s to the early 1890s. Now, it's within that period, that 25 to 30 year period, that the actual physical location of the money pit is essentially lost. Again, going to the records and the lack of, the lack of clarity that sometimes can be in these records. But that clarity kind of, you know, is inconsistent. Sometimes it's really good, sometimes it's not. Now, searchers have been trying to relocate that location of the money pit ever since. Now, fast forward to sometime this offseason. Dan Henske, the veteran hunter who's been on the island for decades and worked with Dan Blankenship, Henske is reading through a mountain of papers left by an old searcher named Mel Chappell. Now, Chappell spent most of his life involved in the Oak Island search. So when I say he has a mountain of papers, I literally mean a mountain of papers. Now, looking through the old records and trying to find some clues that can help the current search is something that Dan Henske is very good at and has been doing for a very long time. In fact, it's something that really every searcher has been doing, since this whole thing began ages ago. Within this mountain of papers, Dan finds a record of that trench that I mentioned earlier leading all the way out to the beach, out to the ocean. Now, remember I said that records, good records are kept of Shaft 9. But just not the trench. But since the trench leads out to the beach and comes up to the point of, you know, only being a few feet underground, it stands to reason that if they can find the trench, they can then follow the trench all the way to Shaft 9. If they can find Shaft 9, it's not only a landmark that can help them locate the money pit using the old records, but remember, I also said it was used as a drain for the money pit, so it stands to reason there must be some sort of connection between Shaft 9 and the money pit itself. So needless to say, and I can't emphasize this enough, finding Shaft 9 can be huge. Now, last week, they found the end of the trench on the ocean side of the road that kind of runs around the south end of the island. So in this week's episode, Steve Guptill plots a location on his GPS, this incredible machine that I really want to have one of. And that allows them to find it again on the other side of the road. So that gives Steve 2 points to plot on a line and gives him a real chance of following this all the way up to Shaft 9. And that's exactly what they do. And the fact that they can do that now, you know, I'll say it again, Guptill's contribution to the team is going to be huge. Here is exactly why. You know, they plot these two. A lot of times you'd be making guesses. Now you're making really educated guesses, and then they find exactly where they need to go. So with Billy Gerhardt behind the wheel of the excavator, they begin digging. And soon they hit wood, indicating that perhaps they found the shaft. And then a couple of guys, including Scott Barlow. Now, Scott's new to the team. He is kind of like a foreman for these projects. These couple of guys, I think him and it might be Kroll or some, you know, certainly Troutman is down there too. They get down in the pit and start hacking away with shovels. Now, I have to say this. There's literally no chance on this earth that you would get me to climb down into a pit that is just being dug out by an excavator and can at any point presumably open up into a giant shaft under my feet for which I could fall into. But then again, That's not the only reason I'm a podcaster, not a treasure hunter. So, all the researchers there verify the dimensions of what they're finding here with the records that they have. And then they even, find the point where the water opens up and the trench that we talked about before, the drain, meets the shaft. It seems pretty clear to everyone that this is Shaft 9. And like I said, this is a huge seminal moment in the recent history of the Oak Island search. The episode ends with Rick saying something along the lines of, it's time to head up to the computer in the interpretive center and plot all this information in, and then likely turn to Steve Guptill to formulate what will be perhaps the most educated and best guess on the real location of the money pit that has been made on Oak Island in the last 150 years. This is truly exciting stuff for anyone interested in Oak Island, and I can't wait for it to play out. Now let's back up a bit in the episode. Into the war room comes author Darcy O'Connor and his daughter Miranda. O'Connor is one of the legendary Oak Island historians and writers working today. He is a Canadian journalist who spent nearly half a century researching and writing about the topic of Oak Island. His first published account was a 1970 article written in the Wall Street Journal, but that was just the beginning for him. In his seminal work, a book called The Secret Treasure of Oak Island, O'Connor says that over his decades of, quote, writing, making films, and lecturing on the subject, I have interviewed, corresponded with, or examined the records of every person who has ever taken part in the search, end quote. Now, perhaps it's O'Connor's wish not to be on the cast of The Curse of Oak Island show. But if the Laginas and the producers were really trying to put together a collection of Oak Island Hall of Famers, so to speak, for the search and for the show, you know, people who can speak with real authority on the entire 200-year-plus history of the hunt, the one man, the one glaring omission, the one guy really missing from this group is Darcy O'Connor. So needless to say, when he comes on the show and is prepared to talk about his theories and his work, Oak Island fanatics like myself sit up straight and pay attention. Unfortunately, as is usual, the show only gives this legend about 3 minutes of talk time to discuss a theory he's spent nearly 50 years working on. So let's give him a little more than that here. The final chapter in his aforementioned book is called The Possible Spanish Connection, and it lays out his belief that the originators of the money pit are related in a variety of possible ways to the Spanish conquest of the New World. He writes, quote, the deposits may have been made by the Spanish themselves or by the people whose wealth they were plundering or by others who relieved the Spanish of their ill-gotten loot, end quote. Now, O'Connor leans mostly towards the Spanish themselves doing it, but I always respect the theorist who can cast a wide enough net as to not make it sound like he's totally convinced or entrenched into his own sort of narrow theory. So just to clarify a bit, the Spanish connection, in air quotes, means that means that the work done in Oak Island could have been done by three different groups who are connected to the Spanish and to this period of Spanish conquest. Either the one group being either the Spanish themselves, another, the First Nations tribes that the Spanish were stealing from, and let's face it, destroying along the way. Or thirdly, someone who may have stolen it from the Spanish, like pirates, or maybe the English or the Dutch, or one of the many countries Spain was warring with during this time. But like I said, O'Connor leans towards the idea that the Spanish did this themselves. The Spanish did the digging and the depositing. So let's pull this idea apart and examine it just a little bit more. The show has talked endlessly about the Knights Templar, Freemasons, and the like, but they really have not given the Spanish theory its due, which is weird because it's not only O'Connor's theory, but it's also Dan Blankenship's theory, and to some extent, it's also Fred Nolan's. And by that, I mean that these guys thought that the treasure on Oak Island was somehow connected to the Spanish. Blankenship believed, like O'Connor, that it was the Spanish themselves that did the work, while Nolan's theory was a bit more complex. We'll get more on that in a bit. O'Connor points out that something around 200 ships were lost on the way from the Caribbean to Spain during this period of conquest. Many were carrying goods and, let's face it, treasure, silver and gold and the like, which they essentially plundered from the indigenous people, namely the Aztecs, the Maya, or the Incas. We've all heard this story. These ships sailed from wherever they did their dirty work to usually the Spanish stronghold of Havana, Cuba. Then, from there, they would sail across the Atlantic back to Europe. But in the mid-16th century, the Spanish realized the quickest and easiest route to get back to Spain was to follow the Gulf Stream up the coast of North America, picking up speed with the current, and then turning in sort of a northeasterly direction towards Europe, somewhere around what we would call the mid-Atlantic now, off the coast of around, Virginia and Maryland, and really all the way up to New Jersey or even New York or so. Now look at a map, folks. A couple of bad days of storms can easily blow a ship far enough off course to lead them towards Nova Scotia. If you look at the common route they took, it's really only about 400 miles or so away from Mahone Bay. Now, as I mentioned, many of these ships were lost. Now, some have been accounted for over the years through official and unofficial records. Others have been discovered by treasure divers in the centuries since, but many just vanished. Most often, these were private expeditions, which did the plundering and sailing for the Spanish crown, meaning the king sort of outsourced the hard stuff. When these voyages to the New World returned back to Spain full of their loot, the crown took a share. So these ships usually carried someone who represented the Spanish government's interest in this venture. Also, they probably, had somebody representing the investors' interest in this venture. And once the Spanish either ran out of stuff to pillage and steal directly from their locals, or maybe just discovered it was much easier to cut out the middleman, no pun intended, they just began taking over the mines themselves. The mines the indigenous people used to make their treasures, gold and silver mines. So therefore, these voyages needed to include, you guessed it, mining experts. Before offering a plausible scenario of how the treasure got to Oak Island, O'Connor offers up the work of Ross Wilhelm, who was a professor of economics at the University of Michigan. This is back in the 1970s. He thought that, quote, Oak Island was used by the Spanish crown under Philip II, who reigned from 1556 to 1598, as a depot to repair ships damaged by North Atlantic storms on the way home. In order to allow the repaired galleon to continue its voyage unencumbered by cargo, the site was also used as a temporary repository for gold and silver bullion, end quote. Now, there are a number of reasons why O'Connor and myself don't agree entirely with this theory of Wilhelm's. But it brings up a great point. Many people ask that very basic question. If someone had an incredible treasure, why in God's name would they bury it 100 feet underground? Well, here's a somewhat reasonable answer to that question, if not also, to some degree, fanciful. It was very common for ships to suffer significant damage during storms. And we all know how violent storms can be in the Atlantic. Yet, despite this damage, they were often still able to stay afloat long enough to sort of limp to the nearest land, allowing the crew to make repairs. But many times these repairs, while being enough to make the ship at least somewhat seaworthy, were simply not sound enough to get the ship to the point where it could cross an ocean with tons of metal in its hold weighing it down. They also often weren't sound enough to make the ship capable of withstanding another bad storm, but we'll get to that in a second. So being that the area was uninhabited, yet still the waters around it home to pirates and enemy navies, rather than leave a small party to guard the treasure until they could return with a ship in better condition, perhaps they buried it, using these aforementioned mining engineers to come up with some super sophisticated way of ensuring it stayed out of anyone else's hands. Seems a bit of a leap, I know, but before we pass judgment, let me walk you through the scenario that O'Connor himself lays out to explain how this could have happened. So here's the abridged version. Sometime around the beginning of the 17th century, one of these treasure ships leaves Cuba and heads up the Gulf Stream. In fact, it's part of a fleet of ships, all working for the same investors. The fleet gets hit by a big storm, perhaps even a hurricane that's following up these same currents. Our ship gets separated from the rest of the fleet during the storm, and they sustain heavy damage, causing them to run for the nearest land. As chance would have it, by the time the storm's over, that nearest land is Nova Scotia. They anchor off of Oak Island and head to shore to dry off and start making repairs. Now, the ship's carpenters say the repairs are possible, but it's going to take months to complete. Considering the extent of the damage, the captain and the representatives of the crown and investors on board agree they can't risk carrying so much wealth on such a damaged vessel. They can't risk this wealth ending up at the bottom of the Atlantic. So they turn to the mining engineer that's on their crew. for a way to safeguard the gold and silver somehow underground. So he comes up with a plan to bury it in a vault or maybe a series of vaults underground. And even though any intruders on the island may seem unlikely considering it's uninhabited, he still implements a plan to booby trap the whole shebang. So while the repairs are being done, the rest of the crew, probably some slaves, let's face it, do the work of digging and hiding and essentially creating what we now know as the money pit. Naturally, the engineer maps out all of his works. He makes specific and easy-to-follow instructions for how to retrieve the treasure in the future and hands these instructions to the captain and probably copies of it to everyone else with a stake in the loot. In order to lessen the chance of island trespassers, you know, finding it even more, they decide to remove any evidence of their time on the island, burning or dumping into the ocean, anything that might indicate a Spanish treasure ship or really anyone else who didn't belong there for that matter, might have been living and working on the island for months. When the repairs are completed and the treasure safely stowed away in its new underground vault, the captain and crew set sail and make way for Spain, or maybe back to Havana to properly refit the boat, or maybe even find a new one that they can use to carry their handsome loot back to the king and their investors. But soon, en route, another storm kicks up, and their worst fears are realized as it becomes clear that the repairs are not enough to keep the ship from sinking. The vessel goes down, with all souls on board, as well as any trace or record of their treasure, and also any clue as to how to retrieve it. O'Connor writes, quote, "This chain of events is imaginary, but who's to say it couldn't have happened? Spanish treasure ships did disappear without a trace, and something was buried on Oak Island. Could there have been a connection?" End quote. Now on the show, as well as in the book, Mr. O'Connor cites a few examples of corroborating evidence found throughout the hunt, a couple of which I'm going to poke holes in a bit. One is that he says the show that Fred Nolan found pieces of a Spanish galleon in the swamp. Now, I'm well aware of what Nolan found and what he thinks they might have been, but I'm not aware of any definitive proof that these things were undoubtedly from a Spanish ship. If I'm wrong about this, let me know. The second is that the coconut fiber was also evidence, being that the Spanish commonly use coconut fiber as dunnage in their ships. A dunnage is like the packing peanuts of their day. It was, you know, put into a hold along with whatever they were carrying to keep everything from shifting around, thus making the boat unstable. The problem here is that nearly everyone in this time period used coconut fiber for just this purpose. It really was the perfect material for it. So while it's certainly evidence of some sort of maritime presence, it's not proof of Spanish presence per se. But there are also some pieces of evidence that do corroborate this theory. For one, that now famous Spanish coin, the piece of eight, found at the end of season one of the Curse of Oak Island television show. And that coin carried on at a date of 1652. But perhaps the most important, and let me also just clarify, O'Connor offers more than just these things I've mentioned. There are more pieces of evidence. The most important piece of corroborating evidence that he offers up are the results of carbon dating. Now, the Triton Alliance in 1967 pulled pieces of wood out of a few sort of core drilling samples that they dug in and around the money pit area. That dating of that wood gave a range of 1490 to around 1660, which is right smack dab in the height of the Spanish conquest of the New World, right in the wheelhouse of O'Connor's theory. But like I said, there are quite a few layers and possibilities to this rather wide net called the Spanish Connection. O'Connor points out how a scuba diver from Nova Scotia named Eric Hamblin formulated a rather compelling theory on how the indigenous tribes themselves could have dug the money pit, possibly to keep it away from the ever-advancing Spanish. He also talks about how Fred Nolan thought the treasure on Oak Island was indeed Spanish in origin, but actually deposited there by the British. As Nolan says it, the British defeated the Spanish in Havana, and while extracting their plunder from the stronghold in Havana, a rogue captain or two decided to take something of a detour to hide away some of the treasure for himself. Kind of a nautical embezzlement, of, if you will. Now, do you see what I mean? I'm just scratching the surface of a theory that is 50 years in the making and is very layered and very complex. And the television show only gives us a matter of a few minutes, you know, just a couple of seconds really for him to explain, you know, what could hardly be even termed the bullet points of this theory. But I guess that's why we have podcasts. So that's all for this episode of the Diggin' Oak Island podcast. Let me just take a second, kind of keep you up to date with all the plans I have for the for this podcast for the next week or so. Just completed a fantastic interview with the author James McQuiston. Show fans will recognize him from an episode just this past April, just at the end of the last season, where Mr. McQuiston came to the War Room to discuss his theories and his works. He has published 4 books regarding Oak Island and his theory. And like Darcy O'Connor, he only received a few short minutes of airtime to present it to us. So we're going to fix that here. He talks about not only his research and his findings and the theories that he's come up with, but also about his time on the island with the cast and crew of The Curse of Oak Island. He'll tell a lot of great stories about the people we watch every week on the show. That should be out early next week. So stay subscribed to this feed and check back with it, you know, in a couple days or so. And then, of course, we'll have our normal weekly wrap-up of The Curse of Oak Island later on in the week. Once again, I ask that any iTunes listeners please take a moment to leave us a 5-star rating there. Also, subscribe to the show if you haven't already and, you know, either on iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts. And also a huge thank you, huge thank you to everyone who has left a rating so far. I really do appreciate it. It really does help to get the word out on the show, and that is always the goal with these kind of things. So thank you very, very much. Don't forget you can follow the show on Facebook and Twitter. We are at Diggin' Oak Island. And if you have any questions or comments that you want to send directly to me, you can do so via email at digginoakisland@gmail.com. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Diggin' Oak Island.